Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City,
the Shambhala New York podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host. And today, strap on the Fitbit. Put on some sweats. We're going to do some mind training. We're going to work it out today. So for a long time, the Buddhist tradition has recognized that sometimes things are hard. It's hard to maintain a sense of perspective, a sense of openness, compassion, especially when things are challenging, especially when the unexpected happens as we go about our day. So how do we train our mind to be more resilient, more open? Obviously, there's meditation. And there are also many other teachings for training the mind as we go throughout our day. So this is the topic of today's talk by Natalie Baker, who is, as we know, a regular contributor to the podcast, is a licensed psychotherapist. And this was a talk she gave at our weekly Dharma gathering a few weeks ago, earlier this month. As a matter of fact, visit us at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes and upcoming weekend retreats. Our Meditation in Everyday Life introductory course is happening June 1st, and a daytime version of the course is happening beginning June 6th. So Thursday, June 1st, four Thursday evenings, or Tuesday, June 6th in the afternoon, for Tuesday afternoons beginning June 6th. Check it out, ny.shambhala.org, click classes and programs, and scroll down to Meditation in Everyday Life, or anything else that looks good. And now, Natalie Baker, what were you thinking?
I was thinking that with all the popularity of meditation these days, and mindfulness meditation, it's easy to forget that in the Buddhist tradition, there's actually two parts. There's the practice of meditation, and then there's the second part, which is the study of the teachings. And that second part is the topic we're going to talk about tonight in terms of mind training. So how do we work with all of those thoughts, right? That's one thing that we notice when we sit down to meditate. Endless distracting thoughts fueled by all sorts of juicy hopes and fears. So when we study the teachings in this tradition, the instruction is to try to listen without bias, which is difficult to do because we all are very habituated to preference, right? We hear something, we think, oh, I like that, I agree with that. We hear something, no, I don't agree with that. And so here, the discipline is to try to hold back our judgment for long enough that we actually understand what's being presented. This is also a very good strategy if you're having an argument with your loved one, right? That we hold back our opinion until we actually understand why they're mad at us. The second part of this is that we don't just take what's being presented as the teachings as the way it is, that we just have to believe, but rather that we think about it. And we, once we have some understanding of what's actually being presented, that we contemplate whether or not we know that in our experience, whether or not that's something that we agree with, And the support that we have is our meditation practice as a way of trying to unite what's being presented as the ideas with what we understand through our own experience. So for those of you who've been coming to the Shambhala Center and studying Buddhism or Shambhala teachings, you've heard of this idea of basic goodness or Buddha nature. Everybody who's heard either of those, yeah, right? So just to remind us, because we constantly forget, the heart of the Buddhist teachings are that every sentient being is fundamentally sane. And we are confused about that. We don't immediately access that experientially. An analogy that's used is the sun and our confusion are the clouds, or a diamond that's hidden in dirt. But because of that fundamental nature being good, fundamentally workable, we can practice taking care of ourselves, thinking about who we are, helping others. We can tread a path, and that by treading a path, we can get to a point of greater sanity, clarity, confidence, kindness, compassion. That it's not just a cul-de-sac. So what we do, so in Shambhala Training Level 1, which is coming up this weekend for those of you interested, the main topic is Buddha nature or basic goodness. And the sitting practice we use to let go of our conceptual minds and try to allow ourselves to have an immediate experience of our goodness. Because basic goodness is not a concept, it's not a belief, it's an experience. But the confusion, the cloud principle, is actually our conceptual minds. All those thoughts, right, that we get so distracted by. So we practice meditation as a way of stopping fixating on all the thoughts, all the clouds, and actually allow ourselves to rest in the present moment and experience directly who we are. Which is difficult, right? Because I'm sure you all noticed that most of the time you're meditating, you're lost in thought. And even when you're trying to go out with the out-breath, you're still thinking about it. Right? Am I doing this right? So an often used analogy is the rounding of a stone in a river. That over the years, that jagged stone gets rounded. Over the years, it's a long path. So working with our minds and what arises in our minds becomes very important. Because, you know, we spend how much time being in the present moment, being with our breath in the present moment in a day? How much time? Versus how much time we spend thinking about things. Right? So it's very helpful if we have some other thoughts to think about besides just the ones that go around and around in our heads. And that's the whole point of mind training, is that it's helpful if we have a way to look at our thoughts and to discriminate between what of the things we believe are helpful and accurate and helping us move towards an experience of basic goodness, towards compassion, towards being in the present moment? And which of our thoughts and beliefs do the opposite, right? That keep us in a state of fear, distraction, confusion. So if you think about today, we're going to review our minds today, the movie of ourselves today. And there's two things that are happening on the level of mind. There are our thoughts, and then there are our emotions, which are the, you could say, the energy that fuels the thoughts. And what I'd like you to do right now is I want you just to take a minute and I want you to think about today. You can do it with your eyes open or your eyes closed, but you're going to review how you woke up this morning. How did I feel when I woke up this morning? What did I notice first? Where did my mind go immediately when I woke up? What kinds of thoughts was I having? How did I relate with getting ready for the day? Right? And as I say this, you can be thinking about, oh yes, I was brushing my teeth. Was I aware I was brushing my teeth? Did I have a feeling? What kinds of thoughts was I having? As I picked out my clothes for the day, what was the tone? As I was on my commute, if you left your home today, how did I feel? Was I sad, annoyed? All over the place. What were the qualities of my thoughts? Did I have any surprising news this morning? Anything that disrupted the flow of either my feelings or my thoughts? Who were the main people that I interacted with today? How did I feel towards them? What kinds of thoughts did I have in their presence? When I ate lunch, where was my mind as I was eating my lunch? Did I have one emotion this afternoon? Many emotions? Am I even aware of my emotions this afternoon? Did I fixate on a few topics of thinking? Or did my mind go to various topics this afternoon? Did any of my strong beliefs get confirmed? Either about myself or about others? what kinds of thoughts was I having when I came into the Shambhala Center? Did I have any feelings about anybody that I saw here or about the room? And lastly, did anything happen today that upset me or surprised me? And if there was something, what did my mind do with that upset or surprising news? So now I want you just to like step back and just notice if there was any patterning to the emotions or the thinking today. Like if you were to try to graph it, what would my graph look like? Was there a pattern? Was it chaotic? So now what I would like for you to do is find a neighbor and introduce yourself and just talk about anything, any part of doing this practice of looking at your day that stood out for you. Anybody like to share what you either observed about your own mind or what you learned about your neighbor's mind?
I think we were both just surprised that we both felt like we were daydreaming a lot during the day and not really productive, just going back to the same thoughts of, wouldn't it be nice if this happened, or, you know.
So noticing the amount of time that we're actually kind of in a daydream and not actively choosing what we're thinking about. And that they're repetitive, those themes. Yes, in the back there.
It was really amazing to me that we both shared separately a feeling of empowerment that we had today. And we also, very coincidentally, have a situation at our workplaces where we each have someone who we're dealing with who feels privileged and we are not in that same situation. And so it could be cause for resentment, but today there was empowerment.
So noticing some of the sort of emotional sort of peaks, right? That for each of us, there'll be different experiences that we have a strong emotion arise, right? Did anybody feel the same throughout the day?
It wasn't really about my day, but it was more, I noticed the judgment, like as I was listening to your questions, I was like, oh, well, I had this thought and that's bad, that's wrong, like as opposed to just observing what happened during the day, like that there was some sort of something to fix, basically.
Yes. Yeah, anybody else notice a theme of there's something to fix? Yeah, that's a very strong mental habit. There's a problem, gotta fix it. It's either me or other people or work or whatever it is. Always it's a problem. So themes of noticing how much we're distracted, right? That our thoughts are kind of all over the place. And that there's certain events that happen and we have strong emotional reactions. And that there's often this judger who's there critiquing, you know, what's arising that's good, what's arising that's bad. And then if we add something like an event that happens that's surprising and we don't like it, what happens then to our minds? Do we feel calm and confident, right? So someone we love gets suddenly sick, or somebody loses a job. What happens to our state of mind in those instances? Usually we feel fear. What else?
Turbulence.
Turbulence. Yes, turbulence. Mm-hmm. So our ordinary minds, as we look at them, they tend to be quite unstable. Right? We're not in control of what we're thinking. And we're not actually in control of our emotional reactions to events. We're reactive. And it looks probably more like a roller coaster, right? Or an ocean with a big storm. And we're going up and down, and then left and right. And it's very hard to examine your mind when there's so much lack of control, so many emotional ups and downs, so much fear. And so one of the things that mind training is about being able to create conceptual reference points that help flatten that roller coaster. So there's a tradition when you get a little further along in your meditation practice, and if you decide, oh, I want to, you know, keep going, there's something called practicing the four reminders. Anybody know of the four reminders? So the four reminders are four things that are true about our experience that are not indications that we're off course, that now basic goodness is no longer in existence, that we're actually insane and completely unworkable, which is what happens when we have strong emotions like fear, right? We really lose our sense of confidence. So the four reminders are four things that are true that we contemplate. First of all, we learn them so we can actually call them to mind. And then we contemplate them in terms of whether we understand them. Are they true for our experience? And now we need a drum roll. And the four reminders are: the first one is in exact contrast to our poverty mentality and a lack of valuing ourselves, which is the preciousness of the human birth. So we tend to all have a habit of not having a lot of respect or confidence in ourselves and others. And so this is a very good reminder that it's good to be born human, that's actually a good circumstance. And it's precious. So value it. Value your life. And then we can add to that, not only are we born human, we're born into circumstance where we can sit here, right? And we can listen to these teachings and practice meditation, right? We have a roof over our heads and the basic skills and ability to take care of ourselves. And we have enough left over, both mentally and emotionally and in terms of resources, that we can also give to others. Right? Bombs are not going off right now, so we don't have to run for cover and just focus on surviving. So we're in a fortunate situation. Now, I'm sure some of us are having some yeah buts come up, right? Yeah, but it doesn't feel very good to be in this body. Yeah, but I have to work, da, 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 and I can't do da, da, da. Right? So you'll see as you contemplate this, right, the habit arising of our strong poverty and our not being confident that it's such a great thing to be human and how hard it is to see us as precious and everybody for that matter. So that's the first reminder. Oh, a human life is precious. Oh, I should feel some sense of appreciation for myself and for my circumstances. Even though, right, even though I'm depressed, even though I hate my job, even though I feel very confused, even though, you know, I'm not the weight I want to be, whatever, you know, whatever we use habitually to feel impoverished, right, that just, that'll arise. And then we remember, okay, but the Buddhist teachings say a human birth is precious. Okay, well, right now I don't believe it. All right. That's honest. Right, and then we just, whenever we have the opportunity, we just call that to mind and see, you know, if there's any wiggle there. And the second reminder which is in complete contrast to this really sort of strong habit we have of liking something and then assuming it's going to be there forever. And if we don't like something, right, it can just go and go. That could be impermanent, but the things I'm really attached to, they need to stay the same. And that's how it should be, right? So that's what we do. But the reality is that everything that is of substance is impermanent. Everything's impermanent, including our bodies, including death. Including this day, what you ate for dinner, that person you're madly in love with. All that will change. And we're still in the realm of workability. Death is included in the workability of the path and our lives. Try to think of something that's permanent. Right now, just like, okay, what's permanent? See if you can find something.
What was that? The world. The world? I'm pretty sure there's going to be an asteroid someday that's going to come and smash this place. Might not be for like 2 billion years. But so that was one idea, right? The world is permanent. Someone say something? Change? Yes. Change is permanent? That might be a definition of impermanence. Can we tolerate that? Can we tolerate that everything is impermanent? So then, when we lose our favorite thingy, favorite lipstick, our favorite pair of shoes, right? Our favorite table at the restaurant on Sundays, our favorite political candidate, can we remember, oh, I don't have to freak out over this. This is impermanence. This is a part, this is actually how things are. And that's still in the realm of workability. Even though I don't like it, even though the change causes me pain and confusion and massive amounts of doubt, actually, that's the way things are supposed to be. They're supposed to always change. Nothing stays the same. Nothing. So then, right, the high and lows, right, as we bring these reminders into our thoughts, right, then we don't get as freaked out, right? Because, oh, yeah, I lost my job. Well, yeah, that's what happens. Things change. Okay, somehow that's workable. I don't see that yet. And the third reminder, and this is the title of tonight's talk, when bad things happen to good people. Why does that happen? There are three things. There are three actions in Buddhism. There are helpful, virtuous things, unhelpful, unvirtuous, and neutral. We have apple seeds, orange seeds, and do bananas have seeds? Yeah, I hear yes, no. Okay, whatever. Banana thingies, right? And an apple seed always produces an apple tree. An orange seed always produces an orange tree. And a banana thingy always produces a banana tree. So, you think something, you say something, you do something that is helpful, that is good. At some point, who knows when, but at some point that manifests as a good thing. You do something that's not so great out of anger, pain, jealousy, right? That produces, you know, a not so good thing at some point for you. And if you do something that's neutral, like sneeze, it produces some neutral outcome at some point. And then where it gets really messy is then you have to add in all the other people, all the other sentient beings, their intentions, their thoughts and words and actions, which are either helpful, harmful, or neutral. And then you have to put all of those over time in a big pot and stir. And that's karma. But you never get a bad outcome from a good intention. You may not see it ripening, right? You may plant that apple seed. You don't know when it's going to ripen. And that's where people get confused, right? Is they see, well, that person's such an asshole, right? Always mean. How come they got the good thing? Well, then we also have to talk about that good thing. And is that good thing really a good thing from a spiritual point of view? From the path point of view of waking up? Right? We have our material world values, and then we have actually what's helpful when you're treading the path. And that's what's in the category of the good things in terms of karma. It's what actually helps everybody wake up to their Buddha nature. That's what's in the good category. Right? And the bad category, you can kind of say it's whenever we're motivated by, you know, aggression, basically. Wanting to harm. And it's not punishment either. In karma, there is no somebody punishing somebody else. Which, you know, growing up in a Judeo-Christian culture, this is hard because we all think of a punisher, right? Punishing others. Who's to blame? Karma doesn't work that way. It's non-theistic. There's no punisher. Just like you kick a post and your foot hurts. It's like that. There's nobody trying to make you feel good or bad. So the emphasis in karma is what you do when you meet what's arising. So seeds ripen, right? So you make your train, right? You just walk out onto the platform and the train is there and you're like, oh, that's so great, right? And then what do you do in that moment? You're like happy, and then you help another person onto the train, right? It's like what you do with what arises. Or you feel pain, right? Because somebody's really misunderstood you, and oh, do we hate that? Right? So this pain arises, very old pain, right? And what do we do with that? Do we then stab? Louis C.K., he's so good at, like, that voice he does, like, I'm going to get you, right? Do we try to do that? Or do we, like, okay, I don't need to spread this pain around, right? I can just, it's bad enough that one person's in pain. I don't need to make you in pain, too. So it's what we do with ourselves in the present moment. That's the seed, the next seed that we're planting. So that's what's important, not what's arising. Because that's old. That's from old stuff. Nothing you can do about that. Inconsequential. So that's a huge topic. I just gave it like super superficial description. But this book, the head of the Shambhala community, Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche, he has a really nice, in the back of this book, there's a chapter on each of the four reminders. Plus, there's instructions on how to contemplate. So you could read a chapter and read the contemplations and think about these things. And I'll just say really quickly the last one, because it's a bummer, which is that samsara, which is our state of being in the clouds, our state of confusion, that it's basically endless. It's like Dzongtsar Khyentse Rinpoche talked about it in terms of rearranging the furniture on the deck of the Titanic. Right? So you can move your desk over closer to the window and away from that annoying person next to you, but you're still in samsara, and it still is marked by impermanence and karma and confusion and
the preciousness of your human birth. So practice, right? Wake up, right? Wake up from the dream of your thinking. That's samsara. And, you know, we try to tweak our thinking, right, to make us a little bit happier. But this whole reminder is reminding us that that's futile because it's still our confusion. We haven't yet woken up to the experience of our basic nature of sanity. We're just, like, tweaking our thoughts and trying to, like, protect that nice thought for a little while, but then something always happens, and then we're in pain again. And then we take a deep breath, and we try to, you know, no, I'm a good person, it's okay. And we try to scaffolding around that thought, and then... So samsara is endless. So it's okay to, you know, make yourself feel better and do things that help you. But just the reminder is that that's not ultimately it. That's not ultimately what's going to fix your suffering. What's ultimately going to fix the suffering is waking up and letting go of our conceptual minds and coming back to the present moment. Because our wisdom nature isn't in our concepts, isn't in our thoughts. So the other thing that we can use these four reminders for is that, you know, there's nothing in our experience that indicates that we have to give up on ourselves. There's nothing that you're going to come across in your life that is the signal that you have to give up on yourself or give up on others. And I think in this climate of the United States right now, it's very easy to give up on people who think things that we don't agree with or who are acting aggressively. But the whole idea is that actually everybody has Buddha nature, everybody's workable, and that we try to practice approaching others with those virtuous, helpful things like kindness and generosity and patience and listening, and that we try to hold back as best we can from being aggressive, which includes being judgmental and judgy and passive-aggressive, that we just try not to do that quite so much. Okay, that's it. So we could have some conversation if you have comments or questions.
Thank you very much for what you just said.
You're welcome.
Right then. I wish it was okay to talk about how hard it is more often.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is very scary to feel like a very jagged rock new to the river.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think I would be doing myself a service if I was more honest about it, or if I felt like I could trust people to hold it.
Mm-hmm.
But because I'm not, I am more protective, mm-hmm. not the defensive about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
thank you. I mean, that's really our challenge, is that we don't feel like it's okay to just say how it is, right? The judger immediately is telling us, don't be honest about how difficult things are. And then the other painful part is, you know, and don't trust other people with our pain, right? Hold it back
and keep people away. Yeah, that's what we do. We, unfortunately, you know, our primary biology is to stay alive. And we think that this jagged rock of ours, you know, is too precious in some ways to show others. So then we feel even more lonely. Yeah. Yeah, and it takes courage, right? That's, you know, in the Shambhala tradition, they talk about warriorship. And warriorship is really about being brave to be who you are as you are, which includes not feeling great and being confused and uncertain and in pain and disappointed.
As you were talking about samsara, I was realizing that this afternoon I tried to take a nap, and I have this beautiful view of the river. I'm very lucky, and I have a wonderful place to live with a gorgeous little courtyard that looks out over the river. And there are also a lot of children that like to play in that courtyard who live in my building. And of course, their voices are very high and very loud and very distracting when you want to take a nap. So of course, I go downstairs. Because I'm that guy. I'm like, hey, can you guys just, you know, keep it down? They look at me. Their mothers look at me. You know, the asshole who lives upstairs. So they're like, sure. So I go back upstairs. Of course, it's like 10 times louder, right? So at that point, I'm lying there. And I'm thinking, I know what samsara is. I'm just going to accept this. I'm just going to notice this. I'm probably not going to get this nap. And then, of course, I walk over the window and I scream, can you keep it down, kids? And then four other people from around the building stick their heads out the window, keep it down. I start this, like that's the seed I planted. But you know what? Within, like, 2 minutes, their mothers scurried the kids out of the way, and it was quiet. And I got my nap. But I created a lot of hostility in the midst of it. And that's fine. That's what happened. That's what it did. I am aggressive. I really am. And I'm working with that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of fear about... Mm-hmm. I liked what you had to say about fear with regards to, you know, the political climate, which I think is not something I take lightly right now. I don't think many of us do. And it is not a unique struggle to me, or you know. But it's so great to hear the reminder daily that love and kindness, not in a saccharine way, but in a real way, have to be practiced. You know.
Yes.
And that it's a verb. That's what I have to do. So anyway, thank you for that. I just want to. Mm-hmm. That's my experience with that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, we're, it's all workable. It's all, I mean, we're the most aggressive towards ourselves, and I think that's the thing to remember. It's not so much the aggression that we put out this way, it's the aggression that we put this way that is something that we could just try a little harder on, right? Why is this person so evil, right? Maybe not. Maybe I could just, like, try to not believe the self-criticism that's constantly there judging me. And just, like, I could just, like, label that not true and try that. Just try it.
Can you talk a little bit more about the fourth reminder, the one you talk the least about, suffering, I think? From my understanding, reading in the Mahayana tradition, for example, suffering comes from past lives. That's one aspect of the that cosmology. So I'm curious what the Shambhala attitude or understanding is of it.
Yeah, I mean, so... Just to kind of put it all in the same framework, the Mahayana teachings are within, like, so Shambhala Buddhism is a Vajrayana tradition. Vajrayana tradition includes the Hinayana, for those of you who know these terms. So this is more the practice of kind of just working with your mind and knowing what to practice in the world and what to refrain from, to kind of make it so that you can work a little more with your mind. So it's the Hinayana teachings are much more about kind of just working with this person. The Mahayana teachings that this gentleman just mentioned. So that's when we're like feeling like this is a little workable, and we start to, so the practice is to give to other people and to put other people's interests in the foreground of our practice and caring for them. And then the top layer of the cake is the Vajrayana teachings, where we're using the emotions, for example, as part of the practice. And you'll see all these deities around, right? And they're representative of aspects of wakeful emotions. And there's more visualization practice involved in working with your mind. So the topic of suffering, that's there throughout the three yanas, as they're called, the three schools. And in terms of where does suffering come from, the principle of previous lives, that's usually a hard one for us Westerners, because then we're like, well, but I can't really know if I had a previous life, so, you know, do I have to believe that in order to practice this? And I think the idea of your own experience and how you, to some degree, are still resonating from the suffering you experienced as a kid, right? You kind of can know that, right? That is the principle of the continuity of confusion. So you can also think about suffering as our not really knowing what to do with ourselves, how to make ourselves content, right? How to be at peace. And the fact that that's not clear to us, and we do experience a lot of pain, that is suffering. Clear as mud. Do you, any? He's like, I'm going to chew on that. I mean, we all kind of, I mean, I think the most helpful thing is to just to know, like, yeah, throughout the day, I to some degree feel either confused or in pain, or feel in some way I'm lacking as an individual, right? That's suffering. That's basic suffering.
When you talked about the preciousness of human birth and how we sort of all here have our needs met, how do we think about people who are born into disease and war? And
right, yeah.
Terrible physical conditions
right.
like that.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's much more difficult, right? So in circumstances where it's not given that we're going to be alive tomorrow, or it's not given that we're going to eat or have clean water tomorrow, right? Our attention has to focus primarily on survival. But interestingly, not for everybody, right? Some people can be in the most horrific circumstances and still think about caring for other people before their own needs, right? So it isn't 100% true that the best circumstances are being in this culture, right? Because, hey, if things feel nice, right, we can, and we have lots of money, we can be super distracted too. So the preciousness of the human birth, you can think of in terms of, you know, we have a mind. We have the ability to reflect on ourselves, right? And it's questionable whether animals have that ability, right? Some people say, yes, they do, and here's why dolphins can. But the basic principle is that we have everything we need as humans in order to practice meditation, in order to look at our minds, to look at the nature of our minds. And so because of that, we're very fortunate, because that means that we have the likelihood that we're going to wake up to our nature. Well, thank you all for participating, spending your evening here.
Thank you, Natalie Baker. Thank you. Visit us at nyachinbala.org for more information about classes, weekend retreats, other center activities. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. But if you are in the New York City area, in the general vicinity, you know who you are. Come visit us. Come to our weekly Dharma gathering. It happens every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear these talks live and in person. And it's great. There's cheese and snacks. It's a good time. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, anything, whatever you got. And have a good week. Stay strong. Stay resilient. Later.